720 WGN. John Hanson in for Matt Mubala here for another 25 minutes or so. Chicago Reader is one of my favorite things to read. That's really well said, John. Way to go, me. And I came across a really fascinating article about some student-led protests back in 1968 in CPS school. I was kind of blown away by the magnitude of the walkout. 35,000 students walking out of CPS classrooms and the changes that they were able to make 50 years ago. And joining me now is the writer of the article. Tanner Howard, you're joining us now. Tanner, first of all, thanks so much for coming in today. We appreciate it.
Of course. I'm
so early, in the morning.
Yeah.
You're wearing a Rockies hat, so we're still letting you in. That's okay. You were at the Brewers-Rockies game yesterday, right?
I was indeed. I'm just glad that that the whole Chicago area is not a mess right now because the Cubs are in the playoff.
Yes.
I'm just going to say that, honestly.
All right, that's fine. All right, we'll let you stay here and talk about this article. Okay, so I'm a student of history. I know a lot about, of course, the 1963 protests, obviously, mm-hmm. 1968. Of course, a transformative year here, not only in Chicago, but nationwide. But I never heard about this CPS walkouts that happened in October of 1968. Walk us through your discovery of finding out about these walkouts.
Yeah, for sure. So a couple months ago, I guess in April or so, my parents were actually visiting Chicago, and we made it down to the Hull House, which I'd never been to before. It was really exciting just to go there, and I'd been meaning to do that for a long time. And they had an exhibit, I think, around sort of like Chicago schools and these different things. And there's this poster, this really incredible, very psychedelic poster, you know, seemed very much like a sort of late 60s kind of print. But it was actually about these protests, and it was really informative. There was basically a photograph of a bunch of students in their lunchroom basically going on strike and saying, you know, that they wanted something better. And then there's all this text at the bottom that sort of gives a very, you know, even more than this article, a synopsis version of what happened. And basically it was students at Harrison High School first, and then a lot of other places. Harrison High School is sort of down in like near West Side.
Mm-hmm.
Had enough. You know, they were Black and Latino students primarily in the school, and they just didn't feel that they were getting, they didn't have enough Black and Latino teachers, they didn't have multilingual education, and so they went on strike, and a couple students were, you know, they were, wow, I'm very tired.
That's okay. Arrested, I'm sure, or taken.
Yeah, yeah, a couple students were arrested. But I guess to your question of discovery, so I found out about the poster, and then immediately I was like, wow, I need to start looking up stuff.
Right.
And other than a couple, maybe like two dissertations, one which was turned into a book, and maybe one or two other article, you know, academic articles about this, there's no sort of journalistic, historical journalistic look at this. You know,
I mean,
there's stuff in the archives, obviously, from when it was happening. But other than that, there really wasn't much.
There was no 20th anniversary written in Tribune or anything like that. Yeah,
seemingly not. So I was, thankfully, there was an event a couple weeks ago at the Uri Eichen Gallery down mm-hmm. in Pilsen, where they actually had a couple of the people that I interviewed in the article that were speaking, and they had photographs that one of them had collected sort of on the walls. And so that I went to that event to get to meet some more of the folks that were involved, and basically from there I was able to interview them and then write the story.
What I find interesting is the evolution of the walkouts, that they mm-hmm. obviously, like many demonstrations, they start smaller mm-hmm. and they grow larger and larger. And some of the stuff was festering even in the earlier 60s, in 1963, mm-hmm. there were some mm-hmm. big CPS walkouts. I mean, you mentioned some of the complaints that some of the students had, but these were wide. These were not only specific, but this was also about the segregationist school system.
Yeah.
Mayor Daley the First, his very segregationist school. Mm-hmm. I can't think of the name here. Superintendent of schools.
Yeah, Ben Willis.
In fact,
yeah.
What do they call the trailers?
The Willis wagons.
The
yeah.
Willis wagons. Yeah. That some of these students in the overcrowded schools, they had yeah. to be educated in wagons. So walk us through some maybe the numbers or just the evolution of how quickly this thing grew.
Oh, it was really quick. I mean, but you're right, like to recognize that there is a sort of longer history there. And I think it also it's interesting because it in many ways mirrors some of the larger sort of, you know, changes in these debates and sort of actions. So 63 is largely teacher-led, teacher and parent-led. It's still massive, you know, more than 100,000, I think a lot more than that, go out on strike for, you know, a day to sort of protest things. But by 68, this movement is actually pretty much entirely student-led. It's student-oriented. And rather than being integrationists, you know, not necessarily they were opposed to integrating into largely empty white schools in Chicago, but more than anything, they were just saying, no, like, our schools can be still, you know, mostly black, but we'd still, you know, we deserve more. We don't deserve to have the shoddy treatment that we're getting. And so that, you know, again, reflecting the larger sort of emphasis on black power, on multiracial organizing. So that, I think that was really remarkable, again, to learn about. And I think, too, there was a just an incredible shift, and it happened so quickly.
Yeah.
When I talked to the couple of people that I interview in this article, it's just in within a matter of weeks. And again, they're thinking about it over the summer. Pomone Remy and Maseko Myers, who are actually now married.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, they went to a Black Power conference that summer in 1968 in Philly, and they actually co-led a discussion like amongst student, you know, like high school students at that conference. And at this time, they're already thinking, you know, we need to figure out how to get people together. And then sort of independently on the west side at Harrison, and on the same day at Austin High School, there's these actions. And then very quickly.
And this is in September at first, right?
Yeah.
Mid-September.
Yeah, yeah.
So school's just back in session.
Yeah.
And they've maybe had some time to organize this a week or two into the school year.
Mm-hmm.
So they start in mid-September and they do a demonstration, but it's smaller in scale.
Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, so they, yeah, there's a couple students that sort of lead this, but a couple hundred students in Harrison are, you know, are striking. The two main leaders, Sharon Matthews and Victor Adams, are both suspended for a couple weeks. And then when they come back is when things really sort of explode. So in that period, while they're waiting, I guess, or while they're sort of thinking through
yes, when they have time on their hands, yes.
Yeah, they're meeting with the folks on the south side, with Pomone Remy and Maseko Myers and everyone else. And so then the day before the first major walkout, which had at least 35,000.
Wow.
And it might have been more, I will say. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to put in a bigger number because that's what I found reported, but Sharon Matthews thought it was severely underreported. She was suggesting as high as 80,000. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, there's good reason to believe that it was probably underreported, right?
What did this walkout look like? So what was the day of the 35,000? I don't have it in front of me, but
yeah,
it was in October here. I think it was in early middle October. And 35,000, is it a matter of it at a certain time of the day they walked out of the classroom? Did they hold up signs? Did they chant? Like, what did it kind of feel and look like?
So it was really truly incredible. I think the date was October 14th was, I think, the first citywide march. I might be looking at the wrong thing.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, you have students, you know, again, primarily on the south and the west sides, although a little bit was happening, I think, at like Lakeview High School, if I remember correctly. But basically, what's incredible is the students from each of the individual schools, you know, and they're some of them are several miles apart.
Very far away, yeah.
Yeah, are still coming together and meeting along the way and marching to a common destination. And so they're meeting, again, I can't remember the exact details, but they're meeting in like, you know, just sort of like giant theaters on the south and west sides for rallies at the end of it. And so you had actually major speakers come and rally them at the end of it. And so, but then there's other protests. And again, I wish... I guess they just couldn't get clearance for the photographs, but there's a photo that I mentioned in here of a couple of the protesters rallying down at the Board of Education. That was one of the destinations for one of the protests. And they get down there, and they had a mock funeral for the Board of Education. They had this little cheap wooden plywood coffin, and they ceremoniously bring it out, and then a couple of them just jump on it. And then smash it to pieces. And the photograph, there's a photograph of it that ran in Jet Magazine that was in the exhibit at Uri Eichen. And it's just incredible.
Yeah. So what I find interesting is just to put it, obviously these things don't exist in vacuums. We're talking about 1968. Mm-hmm. You have RFK killed, Martin Luther King first killed in April.
Mm-hmm.
Robert Kennedy killed in June.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a lot of momentum to this. Mm-hmm. And of course, young people were, of course, leading the way on many of these mm-hmm. changes. Did they talk about that, or was this a separate fight on their own? Or is this part of the broader movement that the left had and the progressive causes have been going under?
It's a good question. I mean, I think the students were really responding to what was happening around them. And I think what's so incredible is that they didn't need anybody else to tell them that things were wrong. You know, they're 15, 16, 17, but
right.
They already can sense that their schools don't have the resources that they deserve, that things can be changed and they should change. And so, yeah, it was really truly student led. But yeah, I mean, one of the things I talked about with some of the folks is just the fact that obviously just a month before is 68 in the convention in Chicago.
Yeah.
Something I've also written about recently, and things, you know, that has such a huge, huge, huge historical memory, whereas this doesn't.
Yeah.
And it, you know, that's for a lot of reasons. A lot more people were
TV
here.
Cameras here. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But I think that it's, I think it's a shame that this history has not been remembered nearly as much. And I'm just excited to get to be a part of helping people remember it.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And I hope that you could kind of explain some of the changes that did come, because you mentioned in the headline, or whoever wrote the headline for you, that it did change CPS. In which ways?
I mean, I think the biggest things were just, you know, fundamentally, you had schools, especially, so on the west side, you know, neighborhoods in 68 are still flipping over really quickly.
Quickly, yes.
Yeah, there's still a lot of racial change, and a lot of the schools are not representative of that. So I mentioned, you know, Austin High School had one black teacher out of about 150, even though the school is at this point more than 50% black. And so very quickly, again, one of the major demands that students had was just simply more black and Latino teachers and administrators.
Diversity in leadership, yeah.
Yeah, because, again, down at Harrison, where there was a small percentage of Latino students across the city were being put in remedial classes just because they weren't being educated in their own language. And so, of course, you know, students are... were able, basically, one, to get a lot of principals fired. It's funny, Sharon Matthews said that she thought that was a win. It was actually because the principals were not doing a good enough job quelling the dissent.
Really?
That's partially why they got fired, not because of a proactive sort of thing.
Hey, ends to means, I guess.
Yeah. So, I mean, so that's
or
one thing.
Or means to ends, I should say.
Yeah. That's one piece. But, I mean, then, you know, beyond that, they did get more black and Latino teachers. They got more ethnic studies curriculums, clubs, you know, classes.
Sports teams?
Sports teams. Harrison, the soccer team, won the state championship.
5 years later or something? Yeah, that's incredible.
Yeah. And then a couple years later, and I think this is a really, I wish I had more words in the story to get to sort of unpack the Benito Juarez Community High School in Pilsen. So that school, again, was part of these demands. Harrison High School was really old, and even well before 68, there was a lot of pressure to close it. It was just sort of getting run down. At the same time, and as I do mention in the article a little bit, Benito Juarez High School today is almost exclusively Latino, whereas there's a school nearby that's almost exclusively black. And so it's just interesting, again, until 1972 or 73, Latino students were designated as white on a lot of, I think, on the census. And so that basically allowed the administration to integrate, quote unquote, these schools while still making it, you know, black and Latino students. And so, yeah, Benito Juarez High School is a response to protests and demands and a lot of organizing over many years, but it also allows the officials to sort of resegregate these different communities of color and to sort of maybe, again, kind of quiet some of this unrest.
Going back, somewhere in the story you mentioned about how one of the subjects that you talked to did attend a speech by Martin Luther King.
Mm-hmm.
And while it was inspirational, he knew that there was a sort of a, I don't know how to say it, but there was not a completeness to it.
Yeah,
go on. Martin Luther King said something very specific that he knew would lead to a dangerous situation.
Yeah. Well, and to be fair, Martin Luther King also knew he was doing it for a reason,
right?
That marching into the suburbs was going to cause some issues, was going to cause a lot of backlash. But yeah, I mean, like, it was really interesting to hear Pamon Remy talk about being so young and seeing him speaking and to recognize, again, how fraught this moment is and how dangerous that would have been, how dangerous it was, because they did go march and they did get a lot of violence directed at them.
There's parallels, of course, to what happened at the strike in 2012, the closing of 50 schools. At one point, they thought it might be 200. There was a lot of marching and protesting, strikes, of course, those sorts of things, demonstrations that led to that. It's interesting how Pamon, am I saying his name right?
Pamon, yeah.
Pamon,
yeah.
Talks about the evolution, like he almost kind of hands the ball off to a new generation of people, recognizing that what they did 50 years ago was influential, it led to change, but that generation can't do this now.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
It was, I will say, I mean, just so again, I sat down with both Pamon and Sharon Matthews for maybe like an hour and a half with each of them, and it was really beautiful, the way in which they described their own experiences in their youth and the way in which they were so gracious to me in terms of recognizing things that I'm doing and working on and saying it's you and it's people around you that are gonna need to be the ones to carry this forward. They were incredibly aware of how much they did, and I think that their legacy is something that is really worth revisiting. And it, you know, again, I also, there's a quote from Pomona in here talking about how struggles that you fight for can be taken back, and how he doesn't want to define his legacy and the legacy of this movement from what was taken back ultimately. And I think that's great. And you know, it's not that they could have predicted 50 years of sort of further disinvestment right. in Chicago schools. You know, it's not their fault at all that right. that happened. But what they did while they were young and while they had the energy and the momentum was really structurally transformative.
Teaching a new generation about the past is always important. I like the discussion that they have. I believe it's with a professor from the Art Institute about the mm-hmm. idea of first source materials now mm-hmm. being used to teach a new generation, not mm-hmm. just being lectured to, mm-hmm. but showing first source documents from this period to let them make an unbiased sort of decision on what they, or an interpretation of the time. Mm-hmm. Also mentioning first source documents, the fact that a lot of the numbers that we know and the facts come from FOIA requests from the FBI. Am I reading that correctly? That,
yeah.
that's how we know a lot about this protest.
Yeah.
Or demonstration.
Yeah, so Pomona actually sent me basically this massive full FOIA document that was someone very, he said this person wasn't one of the main student leaders, but was nearby, was attending all of the public meetings and was getting as much as they could. And it was really striking the level of detail they had. I mean, they had everyone's names, addresses, the schools they were at.
They were paying very close attention.
Oh, yeah. In fact, I think one of the dissertations that's been written about this, there's actually the sort of Red Squad files at the Chicago History Museum that are very hard to get access to. But that's how they were able to learn a little bit more about it. So, yeah, this movement was very heavily monitored, was eventually sort of infiltrated. Again, to what degree it sort of changed
right.
things, hard to say exactly, but... Yeah, they saw what was happening, and they were pretty scared.
They were making waves. The artwork is gorgeous here. You mentioned something that they might be something that's on display or sale or
it's Nicole's print that sort of introduced me to the story. It's been around in a couple places. I saw it at the Whole House. I've also seen it at what's it called? The Co-Prosperity Sphere down
okay.
in Bridgeport. There's also, I think, the Pilsen Open House, and Nicole will be presenting work at that in, I think, like 2 weeks or so.
Oh, that's great. Where can people find the story and more information about all the work you do, Tanner?
So the story is on the Reader's website, and there's the photograph. The print is not in the print edition. I guess it's too hard to print.
Right.
But yeah, that's online. And then you can follow me on Twitter, Tanner_Howard. I write about a lot of Chicago history and other things.
Tanner, thanks for getting up so early this morning.
Yeah.
And I'm hoping the Rockies make it a good series here. They got to win a couple in a row here. It's going back to Coors Field, though.
Yeah, they've got an uphill battle, but I'm still a believer.
Tanner, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We'll wrap things up next here on 720 WGN.